Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Thank you very much. I'm going to try to keep to 20 minutes. I sent Nelson a 60-page paper that I've cut down. I should say that I'm a labor historian by training, so the title that I really think about is How the Longshoremen Shaped the Port of New York, and I would take issue with Mark's comments about the garment industry being, you know, not being, well, we can get to that later. This essay is drawn from a larger book project that's really a social history of the Port of New York and New Jersey, looking at the waterfront. It's rich in history dealing with organized crime, communists, Jesuit priests, politicians, muckraking reporters, and public policy, and a cast of characters that I think would make a Hollywood film screenwriter's dream. In fact, it did. So I'm trying to sort of pull this all together through the framework of political economy, looking at the role that the union on the East Coast played in shaping public policy and economic policy. Between the 1950s and 1970s, political and business and union leaders transformed shipping on the New York waterfront. In the 1950s, New York's port was the largest in the United States, its piers teeming with warehouses, trucks, and tens of thousands of longshoremen. By the late 70s, the piers were rotting, the surrounding waterfront neighborhoods economically depressed, and most of the waterfront jobs gone. Much like the burned-out buildings of the South Bronx, the decaying waterfront became a symbol for the larger decline of New York City. What happened to the waterfront is on some level simple. As waterborne businesses moved to the newly constructed piers in neighboring New Jersey, in some ways paralleling runaway shops of the same era. The common explanation for this dynamic shift has been that the introduction of the shipping container in 1956 so thoroughly revolutionized shipping that in 20 years the New York City waterfront was dead. This deterministic reading, however, misses several important aspects of the larger waterfront story. The New York waterfront in the 1950s was less a unified and cohesive entity. Rather, it was a collection of waterfronts, Brooklyn, Manhattan, Staten Island, and finally New Jersey, and local actors. While many spoke of the Port of New York at the time, in reality, it was a deeply fragmented port. Starting in the 1950s, the waterfront regime changed as locally run businesses, institutions, and organizations started to give way to regional ones, creating one metropolitan port. The container is, of course, centrally important to this change. However, the container did not in and of itself change this shipping regime. Rather, in this paper, I want to argue that the container itself was incorporated into an already shifting economic regime, that the container was, in fact, framed by this regime. My work places the political economy of the waterfront as shaped by business, labor, and politicians at the forefront. The container has been an all-too-easy explanation for the Port of New York's rapid transformation between the 1950s and 1970s, because the economic changes were mostly invisible to the public's eye, while the container itself remained in full view. In the 1940s and 50s, the waterfront had been visible as a working economic space, complete with tens of thousands of longshoremen on crowded New York City streets. By the 70s, only a few thousand workers toiled on the docks, and those docks were hidden by highways and moved from the center of the metropolis to the periphery in New Jersey and Staten Island. Deserted and decaying piers and the ever-present container seen on the back of trucks on the streets and highways of America served as the visible remnants of a once vibrant waterfront. The changes affecting the Port of New York were not simply caused by technology or abstract economic forces, but rather by what historian Michael Fine calls in his forthcoming book, grinding politics, real people making hard-nosed decisions. That means people changed the port through policies broadly defined. They decided how technology and modernization would happen in the port. The geographer Andrew Herrod, who I think has written some of the best work on this, argues that longshoremen through labor relations shaped the physical and economic space of the waterfront. He views space as fluid and socially constructed through everyday activities. I hope to build on his insights and suggest how the political economy of the waterfront was framed through everyday actions of workers. The story of the New York waterfront is one of conflict and compromise within a rapidly changing environment. The number of longshoremen in the New York metropolitan area decreased from a high of 55,000 in the mid-1950s to 2,700 by 2000. Yet the tonnage moved through the Port of New York increased from 13.2 tons of cargo to 44.9 million tons during the same period. It's a 95% decrease in the workforce and a 3,118% in productivity per longshoreman. That's about as good as my economics goes. While the number of longshoremen has decreased, the average salary has drastically increased. Longshoremen have done what most blue-collar workers only dreamt of. They preserved a middle-class wage. They've also transformed longshoring from casual, unskilled labor to a technologically skilled craft. Quote, to American unions, globalization is a nefarious force that has been wiped, that has wiped out the jobs of millions of well-paid blue-collar workers, according to a Business Reporter. But, quote, the members of one union, and this applies to both coasts, I would argue, have played the global trading system as well as any international investor. Globalization has been nothing but a blessing to them. They might be the only workers in America that had that. How did this come to be? Well, starting in the 1940s, the International Longshoremen's Association, the ILA, the East Coast Longshoremen's Union, operating within a web of regulatory agencies and competing business interests, negotiated a series of labor contracts that framed the political economy of the waterfront, setting the stage for containerization and modernization. A smooth transition to the new intermodal economy proved impossible, since the shipping industry was one of the most regulated industries in America. And containerization did not alter this quickly. The federal government regulated who could enter shipping and who could not. Yet intermodalism, the integrated system of transportation that containerization ushered in or helped usher in, did loosen the regulatory hold. And it allowed the union to temporarily fill the void and define some of the parameters of shipping. The Port of New York saw a unique convergence of forces. Federal regulation via the Maritime Commission, the Department of Labor, the Jones Acts, which regulated shipping, state regulation and the oversight via a waterfront commission and federal and state labor mediation and regulations, and local and state politicians. In short, the Port of New York was one of the most heavily regulated and watched workplaces in all of America at the time. Added to this was a shift in the shipping industry, a move to foreign flags, consolidation of shipping lines, and the division between shipping and stevedoring companies provided the vacuum that allowed the union, albeit a sort of weak at times and exceptionally corrupt union, to fill some of this void and play an important role in shaping the industry. In the 1950s, the level of corruption was so publicly visible that journalist Malcolm Johnson, and the actions of the waterfront priest, Father John Corydon, became famous throughout the country. Johnson, an investigative reporter for the New York Sun, wrote a series entitled Crime on the Waterfront, which brought him the Pulitzer, which brought national attention to just how corrupt the waterfront was and exceptionally how violent it was. Father Corrigan fought on the streets of New York with organized crime. The result is, one of the results is the film On the Waterfront, where Carl Malden plays Father Corrigan. The kickbacks, the violence, the corruption, the level of organized crime were all real. They didn't have to be made up for Hollywood. Yet the ILA and the industry soon, because of this visibility, soon witnessed increased governmental intrusion into the waterfront. In 1951, at the height of what appeared to be a string of violent strikes that crippled the industry, a board of inquiry investigation of the waterfront ordered by New York Governor Thomas Dewey created the New York State Crime Commission, which provide great records for historians. It was charged with investigating and cleaning up the waterfront. The commission held a series of public hearings looking into the hiring practices, the shape-up, which they saw at the center of corruption in the industry. The board called for a full-time mediator and Atlantic coast-wide bargaining rather than standard negotiations port by port. The commission put the industry on notice. It would no longer be able to negotiate in private if it ever really did. Now there was a new layer of regulation and investigation at the state level. The Board of Inquiry and the New York State Crime Commission moved the regulatory framework from the industry and opened the door for a new bi-state federally endorsed waterfront commission to oversee the waterfront. While the union opposed and vocally fought the waterfront commission, that body was essentially responsible for decasualization of the workforce and thereby indirectly strengthened the union. The Waterfront Commission, seeing the shape-up as the root of all waterfront evils, changed the process of how workers were hired. Its plan was to replace the shape-up with government-supervised hiring halls, thereby bypassing hiring bosses. The first step in this process was to register and certify all longshoremen. This would prove the first key step to decasualization of the workforce, for it to find who was and who was not a longshoreman, thereby removing the casual worker and shrinking the available pool of workers to provide more work for those left. Decasualization essentially did what the union could not do for itself. The commission, through its program, took on the traditional role of a union by shrinking the available workforce. While the ILA was dealing with the Waterfront Commission imposing it at every step, a rank-and-file revolt against the union's gangsterism created the civil war in the union. You know, I think one of the things that's interesting is that the union, you know, corrupt union with government oversight, fighting on the left and on the right, actually was able to make have some impact on the industry is important, I think. Many longshoremen resented the violence in the ILA's trigger locals, so named because often political differences were settled at gunpoint. Union activists were gone, went missing. As a result, in 1953, the American Federation of Labor threw the ILA out and created the new union, the AFL-ILA, later renamed the International Brotherhood of Longshoremen, which was backed by the Teamsters, in the hopes of capturing the old ILA membership and directly challenging that union in elections. They challenged them in three sets of elections, 53, 54, and 56. In an effort to protect itself, the ILA, the sort of thrown-out ILA, sought to isolate its challengers by going regional. If the ILA could get a regional contract, it could offer more for its workers than the AFL union. And the 1957 contract with the New York Shipping Association, which represented the employers, in essence drove the AFL union out of business. All of this happened, you know, essentially before containerization was introduced in the port in 1956. The containerization, Malcolm McLean's, you know, first ship sailing, the Ideal X, coincided with the Waterfront Commission's decasualizational efforts and the ILA's quest for a coastwide master contract and its fight within the labor ranks for supremacy over its challenger union. All of this takes place all at the same time. And at first, the adoption of containerization was slow. 1966, 10 years after it's introduced, only 3% of the general cargo going through the Port of New York was containerized. By 1970, 12% of New York's cargo was on containers, and the number was growing quickly. By the mid-90s, it's 2.3 million containers going through the port. How did workers and their unions respond to the changing conditions that threatened their very existence? Because they recognized that containers would change their lives. How do they protect their jobs? And I think here the story in New York, on the docks of New York, is important. The ILA developed a comprehensive strategy to protect both the jobs and the port of New York before containerization transformed the industry. Longshoremen leaders such as Teddy Gleason saw the transformative power of the container early, when many in the business of shipping did not. Gleason testified before Congress in 1955, and he summed up the union's stance. Quote, we are not against advances in machinery or mechanization in the industry. We're just going to protect our people, he said. The union dealt with the threat of containerization early on in its 1959 contract. The 59 agreement recognized that, quote, any employer shall have the right to use any and all types of containers without restriction, end quote, opening the door to containerization era. To get full containerization, however, employers had to agree to two concessions. First was a container royalty paid on each container entering the port. The tax originally was going to the union directly, and then it went to another organization for wages. Second, quote, any work performed in conjunction with loading or discharging of containers from non-members of the New York Shipping Association, which is performed in the port of Greater New York, whether on piers or terminals controlled by them, or whether through direct contracting out, shall be performed by ILA labor. In other words, all loading of containers on or off the pier would be done by union labor. Speaking in 1959, Teddy Gleason saw the future, and he said, quote, "I believe that the cargo container will be forced on shipping lines throughout through competition. I'm convinced that it has got to come, and when it does come, its effects on us can be tremendous. At stake also is the merit of a strong union. We are a union of dock workers. We have the ocean at our backs. Any shrinkage in jobs means a permanent reduction in our union size." This strategy led to a coastwide master contract. In addition, new work rules, and finally a guaranteed annual income system that would, quote unquote, take care of any worker displaced by technology. In short, rather than resist the new technological changes, the union embraced them, and in the embrace steered the industry in a direction that they saw as mutually beneficial to both labor and management. They traded the acceptance of new ways of working more efficiently for job security and protection, not just of union members, but what they saw as their port. The 1959 contract, no cut and dried matter, however. Many containers came to the pier fully loaded. But what about those that were partially loaded? Under this contract, businesses wanted to ship a partial load of goods, in other words, half a container, had to ship the goods to the pier, have the ILA members load it. If they moved the stuffing off-site, they risk having their container unloaded and restuffed by the union members at a considerable cost. In an effort to escape the clause and use cheaper labor, many of the businesses simply move their operations away from the docks, consolidating shipments elsewhere, and then sent full containers to the port. The idea being what the ILA didn't know wouldn't hurt them. Right? The issue percolated throughout the 1960s and came to a head during a drawn-out strike in 1968. As part of the settlement that was reached in 69, a weakened New York Shipping Association accepted what were called the rules on containers, or as it was more commonly known, the 50-mile rule. The contract gave the ILA jurisdiction to stuff and load any and all, quote-unquote, consolidated full containers or partial containers coming from within a 50-mile radius of any contract port. It also allowed the union to strip and reload containers stuffed by companies beyond the 50-mile radius who moved there solely to avoid the contract, giving the union what essentially amounted to police powers to protect the waterfront industry from what they saw as the incursions by the trucking industry. This meant that the ILA could investigate containers, follow trucks, and refuse to load suspect goods. If a container was found in violation of the rule, the ILA could unpack it, restuff it, and fine the company $1,000, plus slow down delivery, thus raising transportation costs considerably. It also forbid the New York Shipping Association from leasing containers to violating firms. Without containers and without the ILA, the companies could be driven out of business. The 68-69 strike was remarkable because it lasted over 100 days. It crippled the shipping industry. It cost millions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars, to the national economy. And the staggering cost of the strike led to a deeply divided shipping association to give the ILA essentially what it wanted. The New York locals had, in effect, forced almost all North Atlantic ports to accept the new rules in an effort essentially to protect local jobs and their local port. The New York Shipping Association had a vested interest as well. It wanted to protect their own businesses, which were threatened by inland consolidators and warehousers. In short, the new union rules, as they saw it, were good for business as well as labor. The novel feature here is union authorship. Right? The union's ability to draw a line many miles from the waterfront to define where the waterfront would end. And that's something Andrew Herrod has pointed out quite well. The union's ability to actively frame the waterfront gave the union enormous power at a time of great economic flux. The ILA developed a leadership position in the industry during this period by forcing industry to respond to its initiatives. Right. Containerization obviously brought new requirements for the industry and a need for newer and bigger ships to take full advantage of the efficiencies inherent in the system. Okay. By 1967, the North Atlantic trade would be conducted by only 20% of the then current shipping tonnage, forcing a selling off of older, less efficient ships to foreign flagged companies. This meant that there would be fewer ships making fewer port calls, requiring fewer longshoremen, thus bringing crisis to the waterfront, essentially putting ports into competition with each other. Right. I'll skip over some of this. Okay. In March 1968, the Waterfront Commission announced that the competition between ports became very important, and they said that in the longer paper I deal with, the union actually was able to negotiate some of this. One of the issues that the union was trying to deal with is to keep the number of longshoremen on a register that the Waterfront Commission issued at a small number to keep the competition, the job competition, in check. In 1968, however, the Waterfront Commission opened up the register, allowing 600 new men to come in. And it did that, it actually changed the category. It did this a couple of times. It created a new sort of category of workers. These new workers were not eligible for the guaranteed annual income. They were not part of the same bargaining unit. They were sort of tiered down. And that was a pattern that was going on throughout the industry. The situation in the New York waterfront demonstrates, I think, how the story of containerization, as it has been told, is top-down, business-driven innovation, rests on what I would see as some false realities. When Malcolm McLean introduced the first container service in 1956, the future of that technology was uncertain. Industrial relations, inter- and intra-union splits, outside government agency, Cold War politics, and other factors shaped the way containerization unfolded. The story in New York demonstrates that even a relatively weak organization like the ILA, and it clearly was weak, divided, undemocratic, could have a significant impact on the industry going through a chaotic period of time. Without much recognition, the union helped shape the industry when the industry was deeply divided. The union drove this change rather than reacting to it. In a weak industrial relations system, one that relied on state and federal mediation, injunctions, and a bevy of governmental agencies, the union benefited as outside forces stabilized and regulated the industry in ways that the union could not do on its own. For a time, the ILA led the industry. Thank you.
Thank you. I was going to bring one of those clickers, you know, to count things today. I was going to try and count the number of times I heard the word revolution. But figured it would probably not be necessary because I heard it quite a few times. I don't know if you happen to notice that I was watching for it. Everyone who has spoken so far, I think, has said the word revolution at least once. And I sat down thinking about, I wanted to give this paper critiquing the idea of the box as a revolution, but I wanted to, you know, check my facts first and think, you know, maybe it is revolutionary. So I came up with a metaphor. I like, you know, Aristotle. Wanted to come up with my metaphor, and what I came up with was a 2003 MIT experiment, not one that I did, taking Bose-Einstein sodium condensates down to 500 picokelvin. That's very close to absolute zero. And what happens when you get very near absolute zero, you don't even have to get all the way there. It's possibly not even theoretically possible. But if you get pretty darn close, you get something called superfluidity. This defiance of common sense, where this condensate loses surface friction, achieves a viscosity actually of zero, begins exhibiting behavior that defies common sense. And you know, containerization really does do that in many ways. As Mark Levinson has pointed out, it drives down transportation costs to a point where it almost no longer matters where you put a manufacturing entity, as long as it gets somehow distributed to the consumers. You know, the cost of transporting goods from producers to consumers used to cause serious frictions in international trade. It seems we have achieved superfluidity, this revolution in global commerce, a world without friction, a world of superfluidity brought on by Malcolm McLean, a Lowden genius, an entrepreneur, a trucking magnate turned the Edison of the container revolution, as a different historian has put it. And we've got this boom in world trade. You know, you've got Chinese-manufactured plasma TVs unloaded from a shipping box into a giant box store. Another example I found, frozen shrimp products from Thailand, from Singapore, from China and Vietnam get shipped in reefer containers to Thai restaurants in Minneapolis. with, as their website puts it, consistent quality, on time, at the best available current market prices. You've got these container ship-ready ports, mind-boggling size around the world, built from scratch in far-flung corners of the world, from Singapore to Dubai to Los Angeles. And perhaps most revolutionary, this whole system seems so stateless, just absolutely devoid of states, of so defiant of political boundaries, of national, of ethnic identities. That shrimp, again, it's shrimp harvested and quick-frozen in Thailand, Vietnam, as well as China, but it all gets packaged into a reefer container and sold as China shrimp by, this just slays me, a company called Siam Canadian. It travels on international waters. The ship is owned by a multinational corporation based probably in Denmark or maybe Taiwan. It's flying a flag, though, of a seemingly random country, probably Antigua, Liberia, maybe Russia, whatever, doesn't really matter. Pulls into this privately owned port, which functions as a semi-autonomous state ruled by absentee investors with very little public infrastructure. So clearly, this container hath wrought something pretty new under the sun. But is this a revolution? And of course, I went to the Oxford English Dictionary to figure out where the word revolution came from and was a bit surprised. It turns out it originally was not a political term. It was originally about, you know, revolution of an orb, a heavenly body around an orb. But since the Enlightenment, it has come to mean, you know, political overturning of a ruler or a state, generally through military force. You know, very intelligent people, including very many people in this room, use the word revolution, use it with ease when discussing transportation technologies, especially this container. But, you know, can this 40-foot steel box really be credited with the same kind of historical agency as, you know, American patriots, French sans-culottes, Russian Bolsheviks, Afghani Mujahideen? You know, revolution, I think, is probably too strong a word. But I think the political angle is important here, that revolution, there is something wrought new under the sun here, and it is a political transformation. Because the political history of containerization, whether it's a revolution or not, I'm going to convince you today that it's not. Politically, though, it is also the story, not just of this steel box, but of deregulatory regimes, of tax-slashing, union-busting politics, the kind of capitalism that has characterized America and the globe really since, I'd say, 1973 or thereabouts. We can have debates about it. But is it the container? Is the container the cause or the consequence of these dramatic transformations in what we often call the post-industrial political economy of our own time? Is this superfluidity of containerized shipping a technological force acting outside of human society, created in lab-like conditions by mad geniuses, whether they're at MIT or not, or whether it's Malcolm McLean? You know, are these people who are unwilling to accept society's defined wisdoms of what can and cannot be done in the world of shipping? Perhaps. But as trained as both a historian of technology and of politics, I'm very leery of the word revolution being used in any description of technological change. You know, we can accept that certain technologies have world-changing impacts, atomic bomb, the assembly line, but I think we have to accept that all technologies are the products of evolutionary incremental change, whether it's a big cell or not. The assembly line, you know, introduced at Ford's Highland Park in 1913, was the product of many decades worth of experimentation with interchangeable parts manufacture, continuous flow production of firearms, clocks, reapers, bicycles, all that stretched well back into the 19th century. Containerization, obviously, is built upon a pre-existing transportation infrastructure. Most importantly, you have to have overland rail and truck transportation to make it possible to have a global transportation. You know, no matter how far flung those seaports are, the buyers tend to live somewhere not very close to the ports. You got to get it to him somehow. So Malcolm McLean, when he launched the IDLX in 1956, was very much standing on the shoulders of giants who preceded him, both in thinking about the possibility of containerization, which of course is a very old idea, and in actually building the rails and the highways and the freight terminals upon which containerized shipping would become a system. So, you know, it's pretty easy to argue that the container piggybacked, if you will, onto existing technological structures. But what I want to talk about here is that I think containerization in important ways also was built upon evolving and not revolutionized political structures. One aspect in particular that would seem to be a revolution, deregulation. deregulation of American transportation in the 1980s was undoubtedly absolutely essential to the success of containerized shipping, at least in terms of making it a global phenomenon. Mark Levinson has pointed out in his book that when trucking and railroad deregulation went into effect, it was possible to have that west-to-east overland shipping. Transportation rates dropped precipitously, allowing shippers to be able to conceive of shipping something to the West Coast, you know, on the Pacific Ocean, rather than to the East Coast, even if it was going to end up on the East Coast. You need that inland transportation. And deregulation, in some ways, does seem to be a revolution, an overturning of an existing state structure, because it was an overthrow of regulatory structures that had been in effect since the 1880s, first put in response to the Granger movements and refined during the Progressive Era, shored up during the New Deal. Transportation regulation in the United States was premised on protecting the public interest, as it was put, to have a sound and efficient transportation structure that was available to all at reasonable rates. Before this regulation was overturned, particularly the overturning came with the Motor Carrier Act of 1980 and the Staggers Railroad Act of 1982. Before that, American inland transportation was very carefully regulated by the Interstate Commerce Commission, the ICC. These ICC regulations in the mid-20th century were intended to, as officially phrased in the Transportation Act of 1940, quote, preserve the inherent advantages, unquote, of trucking, of railroads, barges, to keep them all as distinct transportation systems. That is, to use state power to actually uphold oligopolies and cartels in very unfree transportation markets. These were not free markets, but they were meant to serve a public interest in having these different modes of transportation rather than one giant octopus form of monopoly. For instance, ICC regulations kept truckers from competing with each other on price or in geographical regions that another trucking firm already served. They also prevented railroads from operating piggyback container services, actually putting a trailer on top of a flatbed car, without actually basically creating their own ICC-regulated motor carrier firm to do so. So preserving these inherent advantages of these distinct transportation modes was not how you get seamless movement of goods, of containerized goods. You can't have Malcolm McLean's thinking of freight just as freight with regulation. But Mark Levinson has aptly pointed out that, quote, deregulation changed everything. In the trucking industry, deregulation brought chaotic, cutthroat competition in the 1980s, bankrupted hundreds of trucking firms, depleted the membership roles of the Teamsters Union. Certain firms, such as J.B. Hunt, rose from the ashes of the old regulatory regime and created non-unionized, wage-slashing trucking empires that offered dramatically lower rates than their regulated, unionized predecessor firms. Competition drove down all freight rates. The nation's highway freight bill actually reached an all-time historical low by the mid-1990s. In the rail industry, deregulation allowed railroad executives who had been itching all along to get a little more control over their systems, as they always put it. They introduced computerization. They streamlined services by killing unprofitable routes, especially to smaller towns. They focused on their, quote, core competencies, unquote. They began hauling, you know, heavy fungible commodities like coal from Montana to Georgia, or hauling double-stack container boxes from L.A. to Chicago. And they were able to produce record-breaking profits. Railroads produced record-breaking profits through the 1990s as a result. So who lost out? Unionized workers, old-line trucking firms, railroad enthusiasts in small towns clearly lost out in these deregulated environments, but Walmart shoppers, J.B. Hunt investors, container shipping executives reaped very handsome rewards. And it was clearly an increasingly distribution-driven global economy. But is this a revolution? Where did this deregulatory impulse come from? It was fought by a lot of very powerful interests for a very long time. Shippers certainly benefited from deregulation, but they weren't the main advocates. Big trucking firms, represented by the American Trucking Associations, were dead set against deregulation from the moment the word was first uttered in public discourse. Railroad executives always liked the idea of having the ICC be less involved in their business decisions, but they hated the idea of truckers taking away their best-paying loads in a freer marketplace. The Teamsters Union fought tooth and nail in the 70s to prevent deregulation, knowing that deregulation portended deunionization. So maybe deregulation was a revolution, that it was spearheaded by brilliant presidential economic advisors in the Ford and Carter administrations, such as James Miller III, Alan Greenspan, Alfred E. Kahn, individuals who whispered the words of the Chicago School of Economists into Ford's and Carter's ears during periods of rampant inflation. They argued that both antitrust actions and regulatory regimes had to go in the 1970s if rapidly rising prices for consumers were going to be whipped. But maybe deregulation was not such a top-down affair. Maybe it was a result of consumer crusader Ralph Nader, who whipped up anti-status furor in 1970, published a book on the interstate commerce omission, declaring that it was protecting monopolies and bilking consumers through transportation regulations. But maybe the revolution was headed by Senator Edward Kennedy of Massachusetts, staked out transportation deregulation, his own political turf in 1979, and ultimately effectively won the passage of the Motor Carrier Act in 1980 over the deep opposition of entrenched special interests, particularly the American Trucking Associations. Or maybe deregulation was just a product of the mood for free enterprise of the 1970s, when scholars and casual readers alike were listening to Milton Friedman and Friedrich Hayek and agreed that America had overregulated itself into economic misery, that it needed a dramatic transformation of economic policy to face rising international competition and the specter of stagflation. But deregulated transportation was not a revolution. It was a product of a long, drawn-out evolutionary process. Like containerization, deregulation did certainly create something new under the sun, but like containerization, that something had been under construction, I think, for a very long time. In fact, I think the deregulated transportation infrastructure of what we call the post-industrial economy of the late 20th, early 21st century, I think that deregulation was already in effect in material ways in the mid-1930s, at the height of the New Deal, the height of the fervor for a strong regulatory state, decades before Malcolm McLean leveraged his domestic trucking enterprise into a global containerized shipping empire. Even in the tightly regulated motor carrier industry, patterns of very unregulated, post-industrial, if you will, anti-union, anti-statist technological culture emerged well before the 1970s. The word deregulation was actually first used, as far as I can tell, in public discussions about transportation in the year 1949. But language, I think, often has trouble keeping up with material changes because deregulation was already in reality since 1935 and a very important component of the American long-haul trucking system. Because under the Motor Carrier Act of 1935, which brought long-haul trucking into the regulatory regime of the Interstate Commerce Commission, agricultural truckers were exempt from geographical and rate-boosting regulations that limited competition among larger freight, general freight trucking firms. These rural truckers out on the highways existed in a really economically unregulated universe. They existed outside of the tightly controlled markets that benefited the Teamsters Union, that prevented chaotic competition in the core freight trucking system. Also, these regulations that prevented railroads and trucking firms from integrating their modes and creating intermodal piggyback containerized service. These exemptions for rural truckers first entered into the 1935 Motor Carrier Act. Congress intended them to benefit small farmers. You know, generally a farmer hauling a couple of cattle, a few cans of milk, a couple bushels of produce, in fact, cotton as well, bales of cotton. But by the mid-1960s, this transportation of exempt commodities had created this vast, unregulated gray area of transportation, as a lot of opponents of it like to call it. In fact, transportation experts estimated in 1963 as much as 25% of interstate highway carriers were devoted exclusively to transportation of exempt commodities. That is, 25% of transporters were totally outside the regulatory regime. And by the 60s, these were not farmers hauling a couple head of cattle into town, you know, to see what the prices are that day at the local stockyard. These were big-time truckers. These were, you know, if they're hauling cattle, they're hauling them in enormous possum belly trailers. They've got a deep belly to haul more goods, more livestock. And they're taking them out to the industrial feedlots that were springing up in the southern plains of Texarkoma, western Kansas. Some were hauling fresh and frozen produce from California Florida agribusinesses off to suburban supermarkets. Some were hauling milk produced in Wisconsin all the way to New Jersey or Texas, using refrigerated supertankers to really defy geographical dictates and progressive era public health relations that had once made milk a very localized economy. Now it was on a national scale. So often they were hauling raw agricultural commodities, or somewhat raw, but sometimes they're also hauling very valuable, supposedly regulated commodities, like automobile parts or electronics or air conditioners, these things that are supposed to be under the tight oversight of the ICC. You know, you put a tarp and a couple dozen crates of, say, California lettuce or Michigan cherries over your electronics, and you can claim to be hauling exempt commodities. So these are trucks barreling down rural highways, held accountable only to safety regulations. Otherwise, they're accountable only to the, quote, discipline of the free market, as William B. Johnson put it. Johnson was the president of the Railway Express Agency. He was also an advisor to the Kennedy administration on transportation policy. Wrote a 1963 article titled Transportation, the Political Dimensions of an Economic Dilemma. The dilemma was that American transportation, he thought, was carefully regulated to prevent too much competition, but rural long-haul trucking is essentially a wide-open free-for-all. Regulated trucking firms had to obey strict ICC dictates on, you know, what routes they could serve, what rates they could charge, but these unregulated exempt haulers could travel anywhere a road went. They could charge any rate they wished, rates that often tend to be much lower than those charged by the large, regulated, unionized trucking firms. So unregulated truckers provided a model of transportation flexibility. They could travel anywhere. They could charge any rate. They could adapt in real time to rapid relocation of factories, of warehouses, of shopping centers, away from urban centers and into suburban fringes and rural areas where land and labor were cheaper. Now, who are the drivers of these unregulated trucks, this flexible post-industrial transportation network? They tended to be owner-operators, self-proclaimed independent truckers. That's what they called themselves. They were called by the Teamsters gypsies or wildcatters. This is also the last American cowboy, the bandit, the renegade outlaw spending 6 days on the road popping little white pills, throwing his transmission into Georgia overdrive, as country singer Dave Dudley put it, 1963 pop hit. These were the men who drive by night, title of the 1940 Warner Brothers film starring George Raft and Humphrey Bogart as the Fabrini brothers, a pair of wildcat truckers who haul unregulated California produce in what they call their Speedway special, always trying to keep just one load ahead of the cigar-smoking fat cat financier who's hoping to repossess their truck. These unregulated highway pilots were the inspiration for an Omaha advertising executive. He was out trying to sell old home bread to change his name from William Freeze to C.W. McCall and write a song about a mighty convoy. That became a massive hit in 1975. Then it became a movie, 1978, a neo-Western directed by Sam Peckinpah of The Wild Bunch, the ultra-violent Western. And it starred the outlaw singer-songwriter Kris Kristofferson and his pair of Ray-Bans. Along with a ragtag group of truckers whose hatred for the Teamsters Union is matched only by their violent antipathy towards state and federal government officials. But this independent trucker was largely a product not of some masculine white line fever, you know, of wanting to be the asphalt cowboy who returned to the Old West style of life of the old cowboy. The independent trucker was a product of agribusiness's need for this flexible, non-unionized workforce who was willing to work long, sweated hours in order to drive down the price of shipping farm products and foodstuffs to consumers in the mid-20th century. So long before containerized shippers relied on this flexible transportation to drive down the cost of shipping containers from coastal ports to inland distribution centers, agribusinesses in the mid-20th century were relying on unregulated trucking and asphalt cowboys to tie rural farms and industrial food processors to suburban supermarkets. You know, from 1935 to 1980, through what we see as the tightest regulatory regime of American transportation, agricultural trucking remained entirely unregulated because the U.S. Department of Agriculture, the Congressional Farm Bloc, the American Farm Bureau, agribusinesses from Iowa Beef to the National Milk Cooperative Federation used every legislative, administrative, judicial weapon at their command to keep the ICC off of their so-called independent truckers. But these same truckers also fueled a massive revolt in the 1970s, which I won't talk about because I'm running out of time, but violently demanded, shut down the nation's highways, demanding deregulation and an overthrow of a system that they saw helping only the big trucking firms and the Teamsters Union and not these independent truckers. And they were among the individuals, including Mike Parkhurst, the editor of Overdrive magazine, so-called the voice of the American trucker, who told Congress, if the mood of America is for a rebirth of free enterprise, there's no nobler cause than that of the independent trucker, which led, I think, in very important ways to the passage of the Motor Carrier Act of 1980 and the deregulation, which in very important ways led to the possibility of having a low-cost inland transportation empire, which makes containerized global shipping possible. So the container box might be the all-encompassing symbol of 21st century, seemingly stateless global enterprise. But I think the last American cowboy, the king of the open road, is the most fitting symbol of the deregulatory regime of late 20th century capitalism, a regime that, in fact, was not a revolution, but an evolution. And I thank you for your time.
Thank you. As my introduction suggests, I sort of straddle two worlds. On the one hand, the academic side, and the other part, one very much involved with concern with the ultimate well-being of workers in society. In contrast to the very interesting and sharp, detailed analyses provided by the two previous speakers, I'm going to be far more broad-brushed and try to address this larger issue of the role of containers and, in a sense, using them as a symbol for the transformations that have been taking place in areas like Los Angeles. It's worth noting that the configuration of ports, such as in Los Angeles and Long Beach, are very much the result of human will. They are not the result of some sort of natural phenomenon. I think that's an important element to consider. One's almost tempted in the assignment that Nelson gave me, which is how did containers shape Los Angeles area, which is kind of a fun topic. It got me playing around with that. But there is that danger, which I don't think is manifest here, but in the larger scheme of things, to rely upon sort of almost a concept of autonomous technology. Langdon Winner, who some of you may be familiar with, wrote the book, an MIT Press volume, a number of years ago, in which he put a great deal of weight on the role of technology once it's implemented and how it has its own, in a sense, path, which leads to changes and transformation. From my perspective, it is far more important to pay attention to the motivations of capital, the forces that, in a sense, determine which technological innovations ultimately become adopted, no matter how anarchistic the process is. Underlying all this is a fundamental basic concern by capital, that is, to increase profits, to expand markets, and to, in a sense, control as much as possible the mechanism by which greater returns are possible. It's in this regard, I think, it's worth looking at the role of the container, using it in that sort of a symbolic representation of the motivation of capital. Just a little bit of history from the point of view of the region and the ports of Los Angeles, Long Beach, although I'm speaking to the choir in the sense of some people right here, but not everybody fully appreciates, for example, the role of the ILWU. It was a union that was essentially formed as a result of a great deal of struggle in 1934, led by Harry Bridges, hence the name the Harry Bridges Institute. It was that union that, in a similar way to Richard's description of the ILA shaping the nature of what took place in the ports, that the ILWU had that same particular role. This was not a situation in which the union sort of came up to the to in a sense the companies and say whatever you want we'll do. but rather it was always and continues to be this very strong, dynamic dialectic between the union and the shippers and the port companies who do the loading and unloading. The key point in the context of the role of containers from the West Coast was the modernization and mechanization agreement that the ILWU came up with in 1961. That was, in a similar fashion to what you heard earlier from Richard, a basis on which the union agreed to containerization, but at the same time put in all sorts of qualifications, all sorts of standards by which they would then be able to maintain jobs. In contrast, though, to the dramatic decline of longshoring on the East Coast, the West Coast has tremendously benefited. Indeed, the ports of LA and Long Beach have tremendously grown. In 1960, there were about 2,800 ILWU workers in the ports of LA and Long Beach. In 1980, by the time containers were essentially effectively implemented, there were some 2,600 dock workers, 350 clerks, 180 foremen who are part of the union. And now in 2007, we have something like 8,000 ILWU, Local 13 dock workers, 1,500 clerks, 400-plus foremen, and a huge number of casuals who provide the additional support for this. And in similar fashion to what Richard was describing, one of the ways in which the adoption and the control of containers coming into the region and thus the rest of the United States is that this union, because of its control of a key node of transit for the pursuit of continuing the expansion of production from offshore to and into the United States, has provided the ILWU with incredibly good wages. The one point that does deserve further research, and that's one of the things that we're doing at the Harry Bridges Institute, is rather than portraying the wages of these workers as being outrageously high, the real question is, what about the wages of everybody else that's gone down? And I think that's the kind of analysis which needs to be recognized. In other words, rather than the classic image of the crab bucket in which anybody who gets up, the other people pull them down, one of the things that the Harry Bridges Institute is trying to do is recognize that perhaps the model of decent wages and good benefits are ones that are deserving for everyone, not merely for those who are working on the docks. Indeed, one of the among the kinds of transformations that have taken place in the region are ones that we will sort of identify along the way, but one very dramatic one is with regard to the trucking industry, with regard to the Inland Empire area in which you have these huge numbers of distribution centers. The characterization, and this is in a sense the answering part of that question, what has been the impact of containers, in light, in conjunction with deregulation, the fact that you have something like, depending on the number, my friend, colleague, John Zerolnik will give his best estimate of the number of independent operators, sometimes as high as, 16,000. These folks are making, a little over $20,000 a year or something after the net costs of maintaining their trucks. In the Inland Empire, tomorrow you'll hear from John Husing, who is very clearly a advocate and booster for the growth of the Inland Empire, which is one of these major spatial transformations resulting from the utilization of containers and trucking. Those distribution centers, which are located in that area, whether they happen to be for Walmart, these are hundreds of thousands of square feet or more, or they may be more general sort of public kind of distribution centers. These distribution centers rely upon temporary workers. As a consequence, many of the kinds of figures that people attribute to the wages that are associated with the logistics industry, and friend and Kristen Monaco is going to talk more about that tomorrow, about the jobs in the logistics industry. But very clearly, one of the impacts of the container has been the transformation and the relocation of economic activities which once were clustered in the port. It's worth noting that this examination recognition has taken place at an earlier point. Some of you may be familiar with Scott Campbell, who did a very interesting study on the Port of Oakland, describing that very same process at an earlier period in which Oakland's distribution centers and activities sort of moved away from that center. The result of that is that you have what a colleague of mine describes economic apartheid within the logistics system in the United States. The difference between those who are fortunate enough to have been successful in organizing and holding on to that, witness the 2002 lockout, in which the PMA was very much concerned about trying to break the power of the ILWU. One of the great successes in light of the challenges of ports being in competition with each other, at least what the ILWU was able to do was reduce the amount of competition that existed along the ports along the whole West Coast by having a coast-wide contract. In 2002, one of the underlying goals was clearly to break that up so that you could have whipsawing not only between the United States ports and perhaps in Mexico or perhaps in Canada or say Port Rupert or something like that, but also within the United States. I should also talk about the kind of very dramatic kind of changes. Somebody, Mr. Sekula, made reference to the Alameda Corridor. The container has created a demand, a push for the geographical transformation of the region. And perhaps one of the most dramatic ones was as the increase of volume of containers took place. Incidentally, if any of you look at the projections that people make on containers coming into the ports, for example, LA and Long Beach, each time they make a projection for the next 5 years, they've been always underestimates, always more. And whether there's some limit to that, we can talk about later. But this massive increase has created a pressure from capital wanting to move as much and as quickly as possible. One of the solutions that they came up with was this idea of the Alameda Corridor. And let me just make an aside. For those of you who are taking the bus tour on, or the boat tour on a Saturday, try to convince the tour leaders on board the bus to do a detour and not only come right back to Santa Barbara, but go across the Vincent Thomas Bridge. You get a great view over to Terminal Island, then drive north on a little unknown freeway, the Terminal Island Freeway, which goes up to the intermodal container transfer facility, where you see the port truckers bringing in the containers, at one point at least, to the rail yard there. And then you can go up a little further west and then north, and you can actually see the Alameda Corridor. And the story behind the Alameda Corridor is a fascinating one, because this was a classic bill of goods being sold to the communities in which it was built. People were told that the Alameda Corridor would reduce truck traffic on the 710 freeway, which is sort of the major industrial corridor, the Alameda Corridor area. They essentially created a figment for people. They also created a figment that there were going to be a lot of jobs constructing it as well. It ends up being perhaps one of the great tools by which rail traffic could be rapidly moved from the ports through the downtown area and then further on east. That mechanism, which was being described to communities as this is going to open up the opportunity for increased exports for your manufacturing goods, not. The underlying reality is, and this is something which actually accounts for my involvement in the whole logistics area, I was very much involved with the whole area of manufacturing and understanding the manufacturing industry. Bennett Harris and Barry Bluestone, who wrote the book The Deindustrialization of America, included in their analysis of why manufacturing was being lost, in addition to capital mobility itself, was the success that capital had in moving manufacturing offshore. In effect, what you had was the Alameda Corridor providing sort of a greased slide, not for production from Los Angeles going outward, but rather for all those products coming in from Asia and elsewhere through that corridor to the rest of the United States. It was sort of the, you know, a shortcut death sentence for a number of manufacturing companies without fully realizing what the implications of that was. We should also take into account the transformation, the physical transformation that has taken place in the context of this greater pressure, this growth. Remember that the Port of Los Angeles is a man-made undertaking. It's not a San Francisco. It was breakwater that was created with those huge boulders brought in by barge from Catalina Island offshore, and there was only so much land. And as for those of you who will take the tour, you'll go around one place, which is a marvelous illustration of this man-made transformation pushed, in a sense, by the need to accommodate more containers. I teach a class on the Southern California regional economy that focuses on logistics. A student proudly came up to me last spring, and she showed me a planning map of the Port of Los Angeles in Long Beach. And she said, look at this. This is great. This is sort of from the horse's mouth, the way it all looks. And in the middle of the water, between the breakwater and the, going essentially to the south, and where Terminal Island was and Long Beach Port was, there was water. And I said, wait until you go on our bus tour, boat tour, and you will see that the largest, you know, facility in the United States is not on that map. It was created. It is the Maersk, the A.P. Muller, Pier 400. It is something like 3/4 mile square, made up solely out of the will and the desire to bring those rocks in, to dredge the harbor, and to create this incredible port docking facility for Maersk. It is that kind of pressure which has transformed the area. It further has had other kinds of consequences for the region. One of the things that I think is worth noting, in addition to the growth of the warehouses and things of that sort, is the consequence of all that for the environment. The volume of trucks, the volume of ships that have come into the port have created a tremendous environmental impact. As a matter of fact, I should take note of the fact that couple of weeks, November 30th, December 1st, there is going to be a conference in L.A. Called Moving Forward, in which environmentalists and union people and others are trying to assess those consequences. Not only has the environmental impact of the pollution of all those trucks going up and down the major freeways affected the people immediately to either side, but it also has created tremendous pollution and congestion problems in the Inland Empire, where you now have a pushback from people in those communities. At the same time, the ILWU has recognized that there is something about living and working into a safer environment, and they likewise are concerned. So consequently, they are raising issues and challenges to the type of ships that come in, the kind of diesel oil that they burn. And perhaps particularly of interest, because John Zarolnik will be talking about this shortly, I won't go that deeply into it, this has brought together a unique transformation of relationships between unions, workers, and the environmentalists in creating a kind of coalition which is seeking to rearrange the regime, the standards by which ports operate. And given the fact that in Southern California and Los Angeles, we are, in my mind, the beneficiaries of having a mayor who is very much committed to greening the region, he has, in a sense, pushed forward in that direction, in which, for example, the institutions have also been influenced. The Port of Los Angeles board, a commission, is made up of people who are deeply committed to this very same issue. The president of that board, of that commission, David Freeman, is a person who used to head the Tennessee Valley Authority. He headed the Department of Water and Power for the city of L.A. He drew attention, although nobody believed him when he was working for the governor of California, that Enron and the bandits were ripping off the state of California. He is the direct, he is the head of the commission. Likewise, in the Port of Long Beach, there is similar kind of leadership that's concerned with improving the quality of life because of the volume of containers. I do want to also note that one other part, which people haven't really mentioned at all, is the technological changes resulting from using containers has opened up the opportunity for women to work on the docks. In the past, only the burliest, the strongest, the most enduring men could presumably, you know, haul those bananas, could take those sacks of coffee. Now, about 17% of the workers on the docks are women. Admittedly, the ILWU was not always at the leadership in advocating that outcome, but now they're fully committed to it. And what you have, in a sense, is a, an environment in which women are working at the very same kind of jobs, including crane drivers, in a way in which they could never have done before, and they are making something like $150,000 a year. Pretty good job for a woman who doesn't necessarily have an advanced degree. So there's more I could go on about these various kinds of impacts, but just remember that the relationship of containers, even though they are not, in a sense, an independent actor, but rather a tool for the increased consumption, a tool for the increased profitability, the increased expansion of markets, that they've had profound impacts, and I think tomorrow you'll hear a whole lot more about some of these particular details. Thank you.
I'm sure this will work. Okay, so I guess where I want to start off is talking about the bridge building that generally doesn't happen, and so there's this notion that we've had for a while. That is sort of a dominant narrative that, you know, it is jobs or the environment. Meanwhile, of course, both sides here, environmentalists and unionists, are confronting the same force, which is the fact that that corporations can very easily move around the globe, aided by developments like the container, in search of cheaper labor, ever cheaper labor, and ever laxer environmental regulations. And so, seeing this as a zero sum, you know, we view each other with mistrust. So, you know, labor folks hear terms like smart growth, and it gets their hackles up. They think that's code for no growth. Similarly, you know, environmentalists look at, you know, at issues like the Alaska National Wildlife Refuge, and, you know, and have a mistrust of labor. You know, and so then, you know, we saw Seattle 99, Teamsters and Turtles was the slogan. You know, and it was kind of a slogan, and so there have been fits and starts since then as to, you know, whether this has been made more real, made more concrete. And so what I want to talk about is an instance of trying to build this coalition, not only because we are in fact stronger together, but because for some problems, like the one that I'm going to talk about with port trucking, it is only through talking to each other and learning from each other that we're able to come up with a solution that is comprehensive. So, first of all, what we're going to talk about is port trucking, and we talked about how there are some who have benefited from changes in logistics, and some who have not. Port truckers are definitely belong in the category of those who have not benefited from these changes. And we're talking about a coalition in the San Pedro Bay ports. San Pedro Bay is L.A. and Long Beach. These are technically two separate ports, legally two separate ports, but for all intents and purposes, it's one large port complex, the largest in the U.S. by far, fifth largest in the world, and growing quite rapidly. We'll see if the double to triple figure is, in fact, an undercount, as historically there have been undercounts. And people think of L.A. as being, you know, especially with the strike going on now, being an industry town. To the extent that it is, it's not Hollywood. Trade is the number one, by far, industry in Southern California. You know, but unlike here, you know, where we saw how it is an economic engine. Yep, no, that was what I wanted. You know, here we saw that the ports really are an economic engine, but, you know, it's not just that. It's also a lot of problems that are created and gets referred to some of the environmental problems. The port complex combined is the single largest source of pollution in the region, and I think everyone knows that Southern California has the worst air in the country. And it gets also talked about the economic... The apartheid, you know, you have a lot of very high-quality, high-wage jobs, and then you have proliferation of very low-quality, low-wage jobs. And so while this is a regional problem, this is also especially a localized problem. You go into parts of Wilmington, San Pedro, as those of you, you know, who are going to drive down there for the tour on Saturday will see, you know, or near the rail yards in Commerce and Carson, you know, and the health effects there. From pollution, from all of goods movement, but particularly the trucks, and we'll get to the trucks, are very severe. It's also not just a problem for the community, but a problem for business because there are bottlenecks and inefficiencies. We saw the slowdown. In 2004, there was a big problem with getting the stuff through and, you know, scores of ships off the coast, and this is not the O2 lockout. This was just normal course of business in 2004, and also there are safety security concerns. And so, out of a lot of this, and out of the political leadership that gets referred to, the ports jointly, which was historic, embarked on a Clean Air Action Plan. About a year and a half ago. And that's where we came in at the Coalition for Clean and Safe Ports. We, as the ports were developing their Clean Air Action Plan, there was a big gap there, and that gap was port trucking. They really didn't have any sense of how they were going to get their hands around this problem. And they're pretty forthright about it if you go back and read the original draft Clean Air Action Plan. You know, they say, sure, Harborcraft, you know, here's our plan for Harborcraft, here's our plan for ships, here's our plan for railroads, you know, here's our plan for you know, terminal operators' equipment. For trucking, here's some ideas, but we really don't know. So we came together as a coalition last year because we were all separately working on this problem of port trucking. And I'll get to the we in a minute. But what we found was that, you know, we needed to learn from each other's expertise to really have a full picture of what we even meant by the problem of port trucking. And so, you know, not only did we not buy into what I referred to earlier as the false dichotomy, you know, but we found that working together was necessary. So, who is the Coalition for Clean and Safe Ports? It is a pretty diverse mix of environmental groups, environmental justice groups, unions, public health organizations, religious groups, immigrant rights groups, and other community groups. And getting all of these folks to the table was essential because, you know, everyone had some perspective on it that was lacking in another segment. I'll just say very quickly, you know, because it may be a flag for folks who aren't familiar with poor trucking, why immigrant rights groups are up there. Other folks here, you know, who have researched this can give you the stats better than I can. But poor trucking is dominated by recent immigrants. I believe that it's around 60%. Kristen's giving me the nod. About 60% are born outside of the U.S. and over 90% are Latino. And so immigrant rights issues play very heavily into the mix of poor trucking problems. So what did we learn? We learned that there's a very connected set of problems, and different constituencies are hurt by the structure of the industry. And so in a nutshell, what we learned through talking to each other is that the economics of poor trucking and the environmental impact of poor trucking cannot be separated. And so I'm going to go into each of those four areas in a little more detail. So who are poor drivers? Well, there's figures vary, 16,000, 16,800 in the region, and they're called independent contractors. They're not. This is to be distinguished from a true independent contractor who does have some control or direction over his or her work. Poor truckers do not. They do not have their own legal operating authority, and they do not have true control or direction over their work. They are at the mercy. You could call them dependent contractors. And in fact, in Canada, there is such a classification, and poor truckers are dependent contractors. We don't have that here. They are misclassified as independent contractors, and I won't go into too much detail about that because I know that there's going to be another talk about that tomorrow. But these are not good jobs. These are, in fact, very, very crappy jobs. One thing I will say about independent contractor status, and I actually won't say it. I'll let Jack Kaiser say it. Jack Kaiser is economist about town in Southern California. So why did an independent contractor status? Well, a lot of people want to have a business but don't want the headaches of having to actually employ people. By becoming a non-employer, you avoid workers' comp, paid leave, health insurance, taxes. So where does that leave the so-called independent contractor? Well, they either pay for their own health care or they go without. We know, again, through surveys that Kristen has done, that 90% of poor drivers go without, have no health care. I'm not saying 90% have no company-provided health care. 90% have no health care. So the independent contractor status is not just a problem, but it is a problem that prevents a reasonable solution. So you have this problem of drivers who are misclassified as independent contractors making considerably less than their employee counterparts. 40% is the differential based on government surveys. But beyond the lack of rights, independent contractor status prevents drivers from following the path that workers over the history of work have followed when they want to improve their conditions, that is, organizing. Well, if independent contractors are in fact separate independent businesses, then talking to each other about their rates would be a violation of antitrust. And in fact, poor drivers have been ever since deregulation, which gave rise to the independent contractor proliferation, have been trying to organize and on occasion have been hauled in on alleged violation of antitrust. This hasn't had to be used much because generally drivers haven't been successful. So I said that these are crappy jobs. Here are a few a few quotes on making that point. Everyone recognizes that poor truckers are at the bottom of the food chain. These jobs are pursued only by the economically desperate. And an industry publication noted that these drivers could make more money flipping burgers. So it's not just about the drivers, of course. It is also about the environment. Everyone down at the ports says that the ports are where trucks go to die. Yes, trucks are not the largest source of pollution at the ports by, say, tonnage, but because port trucks are driving through neighborhoods, by schools, by parks, they have a much more dramatic impact on public health than, say, ships, which, you know, by far contribute the largest sheer tonnage of NOx or diesel particulate matter. And it's not just the fact that the trucks are old, it's the fact that the way that the work is organized creates inefficiencies, and that's what I mean here when I refer to the idle issue. You know, I don't know how much of this you'll see on Saturday, but, as you're going into the ports, the trucks are just queued up there, waiting to get in, idling. And in fact, 50% of a port driver's day is spent not driving, is spent waiting to pick up a load, to drop off a load, to get into the ports, get out of the ports. And obviously, you know, in addition to the inefficiencies of that and the fact that the port drivers, because they're paid by the load, have to eat that time, have to eat the cost of that time, it does continue to spew more pollution into the air. And of course, you know, there are also public policy considerations having to do with safety and security, and also having to do with pushing costs onto the public. And so I'll get back to this in a minute, but there was reference earlier to the sorts of changes that we're going to be seeing at LA Long Beach driving up transportation costs. And it is a major contention of the Coalition for Clean and Safe Ports that actually it is not going to do that. It is going that those costs are already being paid. It is going to shift the transportation costs, which currently are externalized. They are being paid just by the wrong folks. They're being paid by the drivers, they're being paid by the community members who are getting asthma, and they're being paid by us as taxpayers who have to subsidize this mess. So, those are weird little icons that popped up there. So what is causing all of this, both market problems and structural problems? By market problems, we have 1,400 different trucking companies at the ports trying to bargain with Walmart, with Target, with Home Depot. A dozen shipping lines and a handful of retailers up against 1,400 different trucking companies. Turnover is very high, and basically, you know, we hear the term race to the bottom very frequently, but that's what we see here among port trucking there's no barriers to entry, you have a proliferation of trucking companies willing to underbid each other. The industry has been slitting its own throat ever since deregulation. But in addition to market problems, there are also structural problems, namely the independent contractor status and the lack of port oversight. So, the ports decided to actually do something, and so I referred to the Clean Air Action Plan from which the ports passed a year ago now. November 20th, 2006, they passed that, leaving a big gap for the trucking portion. They introduced the Clean Trucks Program in April of this year, designed to reduce truck emissions by 80% over 5 years. And how it would do this is it would require that any trucking company, and right now the trucking companies consider it a right to come onto the port property and to engage in business, the ports would say, no, actually, you know, it's not your right. It is, in fact, a privilege to come onto public land and make money. And so we're going to set some standards. And anyone who can meet these standards, come on in. And the way we're going to enforce these standards is by having a contract with you, trucking company. And so those two elements, the setting of standards and the contractual relationship are at the core of the Clean Trucks program. One of those standards is the use of employee drivers rather than independent contractors. This prevents what we've seen, which is the shifting of all the risk and responsibility from those least able to bear it, the drivers, to the where it should be, which is on the trucking companies and their shipper clients. This will, you know, this benefits all of the impacted stakeholders, and we can put a price tag on that, $4.2 billion in benefits over the first 5 years alone. And so if you want to see the detailed calculation of that, you can see our report on the Lane website, laane.org. And it's not just dollars, but it's also lives in a very concrete way. You know, this is based on figures from the Air Resource, the California Air Resources Board. So why do we have such a vociferous fight from industry on this? You know, they say, oh, you know, increased cost, you know, they like to talk about an 80% increase in trucking costs. Well, let's put this in perspective. An 80% increase in trucking costs is 1/6 to 1/3 of 1% of the retail cost of the good. This is a cost that can easily be absorbed and would easily be absorbed. So if it's not the cost, then what is it? Well, let's go back to Jack Keiser. It's about shifting risk. It's about evading responsibility. It's about getting to say, boo, Teamsters. And it is about preventing a successful blue-green alliance of the sort that the coalition has thus far been. You know, so what do we hope through a Clean Trucks program? We hope to see drivers stop being misclassified and have their rights on the job through employee status, cleaner air, safer ports, safer roads, improved security, a more efficient business, a reduced burden on taxpayers, and a notion of industry paying its fair share. I did not hit my ambition of bringing it in under 20, but hopefully we still have some time for discussion as a panel.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.